The following presentation was recorded at the 1997 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Who's familiar with Frog and Toad? All right. The story is called Tomorrow. Toad woke up. "My," he said, "this house is a mess. I have so much work to do." Frog looked through the window. "Toad, you are right," said Frog. "It is a mess." Toad pulled the covers over his head. "I will do it tomorrow," said Toad. "Today, I will take life easy." Frog came into the house. "Toad," said Frog, "your pants and jacket are lying on the floor." "Tomorrow," said Toad from under the covers. "Your kitchen sink is filled with dirty dishes," said Frog. "Tomorrow," said Toad. "There is dust on your chairs." "Tomorrow," said Toad. "Your windows need scrubbing," said Frog. "Your plants need watering." "Tomorrow," cried Toad. "I will do it all tomorrow." Toad sat on the edge of his bed. "Blah," said Toad, "I feel down in the dumps." "Why?" asked Frog. "I am thinking about tomorrow," said Toad. "I am thinking about all of the many things that I will have to do." "Yes," said Frog, "tomorrow will be a very hard day for you." "But Frog," said Toad, "if I pick up my pants and jacket right now, then I will not have to pick them up tomorrow, will I?" "No," said Frog, "you will not have to." Toad picked up his clothes. He put them in the closet. "Frog," said Toad, "if I wash my dishes right now, then I will not have to wash them tomorrow, will I?" "No," said Frog, "you will not have to." Toad washed and dried his dishes. He put them in the cupboard. "Frog," said Toad, "if I dust my chairs and scrub my windows and water my plants right now, then I will not have to do it tomorrow, will I?" "No," said Frog, "you will not have to do any of it." Toad dusted his chairs. He scrubbed his windows. He watered his plants. "There," said Toad, "now I feel better. I am not in the dumps anymore." "Why?" asked Frog. "Because I have done all that work," said Toad. "Now I can save tomorrow for something that I really want to do." "What is that?" asked Frog. "Tomorrow," said Toad, "I can just take life easy." Toad went back to bed. He pulled the covers over his head and fell asleep. All right. Let me just share quickly eight typical steps of activities in a reading class for the lower grades. If you're teaching reading to grades 1 through 3, roughly, what do you actually do? Assuming that you're working with a group in a group setting or working with a child, what kinds of things do I do and what's a reasonable sequence? Well, number one is to drill letter sounds and phonics rules and applications. Frequently, we start the class with some of the nitty-gritty mechanical aspects like that because we're going to lead into later on probably a story. And so we start out with letter sounds, introducing new ones, reviewing old ones, using flashcards, and so on. Secondly, something with words, some kind of word activities, whether it's introducing new words that the story will have, reviewing words from yesterday, antonyms, rhyming words, synonyms, definitions, new definitions, multiple definitions of words, to something with words. Doesn't need to be a lot, but words are the tools that we use for our reading. So introduce them to words. A third one then is to somehow lead into introduce the story by somehow making a connection, giving some background to the story, making a connection to their life, some hint about the character. Doesn't need to be too much. You don't want to give away the story, but not just, now let's turn to page 22 and start reading the story. Something to give some expectation, some kind of appetite. You put the salt in the oats, like they say. You can't make a horse drink, but you can put salt in the oats. Somehow introduce the story. A fourth one then is to allow some time for silent reading, and at some point. Now, of course, if they can't read anything on their own, you may need to do everything together at the very beginning. However, in the middle here of these steps I'm giving, they aren't necessarily in the same order every time. And neither will you include all of these things in every class, but these are typical things. Time for silent reading, which then allows you time to go to another class or to help a slow student. A fifth element is to ask thinking questions. More about that later. A sixth element is to practice oral reading. And again, four and six could be in either order. And then seventh would be to introduce the assignment, the workbook activity or the worksheet, whatever you have. Introduce and assign it. Make sure they understand. Done, but that could be at the beginning of a class or it could be at the end, wherever. But sometimes you can check things together and see why the answers are the way they are. All right, let's jump then to the upper grades, upper elementary into junior high in a reading class. We still have as number one frequently working with words, whether it's simply some pronunciations of some new words, some definitions, and your vocabulary work might be part of reading class. It might be a separate class, so it might not enter into the reading block per se, but working with words. And then secondly, introducing the story, similar to what I said before, give them some idea of what to expect, something to look for, some purpose when they read, some expectation. Something to look for as they read. Third, some silent reading time. And if the big question here is with the upper elementary and junior high, if you read together as a group by turns, I mentioned before, if you have 15 minutes and five people and each one reads 3 minutes, does that mean the other people spent 12 minutes doing nothing? Not necessarily. That's certainly not our goal. But in order to be sure that they are thinking, why, we need to be sure they're asked some questions frequently between paragraphs, not necessarily every time. Students shouldn't have the feeling that everything has to be analyzed to death either. We should be able to just read some things and enjoy them, but we need to ask questions so that they can think, and questions can be fun. And then a fourth one, so we do read together or ask to have silent reading. Number four would be to introduce the workbook activity. And fifth, often would happen the next day, check the workbook and discuss the results. And sixth, also may happen the next day, is to discuss the story, ask thinking questions, and practice oral reading. All right, some practical activities. You should have a handout on asking effective questions. Questioning is one of the main activities of a teacher is to ask questions, and one of the main activities of students should be to ask questions too. In fact, sometimes we have it backwards. Probably our students should do more of the asking than we do. But anyway, by asking good questions, we can have them think. So I'll walk through this quickly with you. Some purposes of asking questions are, first of all, to involve the students. First John, he said, that which we have heard, seen with our eyes, looked upon, and handled of the word of life. When you ask a question and you need to answer, you actually have to handle the material and do something with it. And many people can read something, but to have to answer a question about what you read, you have to put your mind in gear and do something with it. So it involves students. You can check their level of understanding by the question that you ask. You can also fix facts in the mind and also have the students realize it's their class. It's a group activity. It's something you answer the questions. It keeps the group involved more. And questions, even if they aren't answered in the out loud, if they're answered in the mind, it still involves asking and answering questions. In fact, as you're out there listening to me, you're asking and answering some questions yourself. And you're wondering, does that idea make sense? Could I use that in my room? I wonder what he means by that. I don't quite get that. And we ask those questions, and that shows that we are thinking, doing something with what we are hearing. And some of these are self-explanatory, so I'll jump down to number 9. You might require your answer to take a stand. Is it good to do this, or was that a proper way for him to act? And clarify something. What was the person really trying to accomplish by doing that? For example, when the Pharisees came to Jesus and asked him, is it proper or lawful to give tribute to Caesar or no? Well, what did they ask? Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar? But what were they really after? See, a reader has to be able to realize, oh, they had a hidden motive. That wasn't really what they wondered. And let's jump down to section 2 here, types of questions. What kinds of questions do you ask? Now, there are probably as many groups of questions as there are people who made up lists of questions, and we have Bloom's, I think you have Bloom's taxonomy, we'll look at briefly later on. But in this list, a rhetorical question is one where you ask but don't really expect an answer. You have books there, we're reading a story, and I might say, do you see the cat under the tree there? Well, the intent is that you should all look in your book and see the cat under the tree. And do you notice up in the left top corner how they changed this, or which do you see which graph is the highest? And you're asking questions with the intent that your readers are following in their minds and answering them in their minds. Or how many of you think it's cold in here, and so on. And you're not really expecting a response. And that's fine. Rhetorical questions have their place. Be sure, though, that you don't overuse them, because some people do not answer rhetorical questions. The more often you ask them, probably the more frequently they won't answer them. And if also make it clear by either the way you ask it or the way you follow up after that, whether you expect it to be answered or not. If you asked a question and didn't plan for it to be a rhetorical question, but nobody responds, why, you shouldn't just move on, because the group will get lazy and not want to answer questions. You should press for an answer or somehow make it clear, not just ask a question and allow them not to answer. Application questions require you to apply. That comes up under Bloom's taxonomy. A leading question is where you put the words in a person's mouth. Maybe you, in court trials, I believe it's the defense attorneys are allowed to do that. A leading question is one where you lead a person over the territory, and he might not have been able to make sense out of it himself, or been able to answer it, but if you lead him right past it, he sees it. And so, for example, if you were discussing the Good Samaritan, and you ask a leading question, you could ask, probably the man who was the kindest one was the Samaritan, because he actually stopped and helped this person and took him to the inn and gave him something. Is that right? Well, your person has sat there and he's listened to you give that whole thing, and you've kind of defined kindness, and all he has to do is sit there and say, yes. Mm-hmm. All right? That's a leading question. Now, of course, see, leading questions can be used the other way around, too. And if you want to see whether your person is thinking, whether he's thinking or not, you can ask a leading question that goes the other way around. And if you just flip that, you said probably the most thoughtless man was the Samaritan, because these Samaritans did not like the Jews. And when he came along, he picked this person up and he took him to the innkeeper. And that really showed thoughtlessness, didn't it? And the person, yeah. You're not thinking. So you can use leading questions either way, but they're one way to get people involved sometimes who will only respond to a yes or no. They don't like to verbalize, and sometimes you can draw people in with a yes or no that requires them to think, though. A practical question would be one that you would actually do. How could we find out whether this works or not? Or where would you look for this information? And so it's a question that really requires you to answer how you would do something or how you could use it. Some of these recalls is strict recall. The next one there, number 7, an inferential question is one that requires you to think between the lines. How do we know that this happened? How do we know that the furnace that the men were put in the fiery furnace, how do we know that that was a rather large furnace? Well, it doesn't tell you anything about the size, but you know that 4 people could walk in it. It was large. So, inferential questions. Evaluative requires you to make some judgment based on some other standard. Is something worthy? Is something effective? Is something convincing? Is that logical? Does that make sense to you? Is that sensible? Is that proper? Was that right for them to do that? Those kinds of questions are evaluative. Was that worthwhile? Does that have anything to do with this question? Those are evaluative. Personal questions would have a different answer with each person. Personal question could be, who has a birthday in July? Well, you know whether you answer that one or not. Or who's been to Timbuktu? Those are personal questions. And they can be interesting because it sheds light sometimes on a subject. Oh, you've been to Timbuktu. Tell us something about it. You want to avoid, though, in personal questions, don't ask something that's of a personal nature that the person doesn't want to answer in front of the group. Take some tact there. Stimulating questions, well, just anything that makes you think about something unusual. What do you suppose would happen if I, as a teacher, went home some morning after devotion and said, oh, you have school day on your own? That's a stimulating type of question. They could imagine a bit what would happen. Questions adapted to the individual are ones that would draw upon the abilities or the individual experience. Now, you might see somebody, you might have somebody in your classroom you know can field a very difficult question. And so you suit something to that person. For example, a very open-ended question would be, what did you learn for today from your assignment? Well, you might have a student who can handle that. But it's a very difficult question to answer. One of the hardest questions to answer on a Sunday when you come home is for somebody to ask you, what did you learn in church this morning? Right? Oh, we don't like to give that kind of rendition of what we learned in church. And yet, what do parents ask their children when they come home from school? What did you learn in school? You talk about high-level thinking. That is a very high level of question, very difficult to answer, what I learned in school today. Much better to ask them, what did you read about or what was done? Well, they killed a rooster. All right. However, be interesting for you to answer. What did you learn through that experience, you see? Would somebody like to answer that? What did you learn through that experience? Any volunteers? Yes. All right. They have tough necks. Something very specific. Anything more general that somebody learned? Some classes are memorable, aren't they? Well, all right, adapted to the individual. Maybe because of something that's under discussion, you know that a particular person has had a certain kind of experience, and so you draw on that in asking your questions. There's a time also for very brief questions. Not every question needs to be involved heavy, ponderous thought and, quote, high levels of thinking. There's a time for brief questions, especially when you're starting out discussing a story. All right, we had the story we read for today. Who was our main character, and where did he go? What happened? And you just throw out some facts and kind of lay the stage for discussion. And then there are hidden questions, which are a bit like I alluded to there earlier, where the things are clarified. For example, when when Jesus and his disciples broke ate corn on the Sabbath day, rubbed the corn out, kernels out in their hands and ate, what were they really doing? Well, there's a hidden question there that has to do with breaking of the law or keeping the law. And then one of the key steps is number 14, spontaneous questions. And as you see, there's overlap here. Any of these questions could be spontaneous. But what I mean by that is, as teachers, we need to learn to think on our feet and learn to ask a variety of questions and be able to think of good questions as they come to our minds. And then there's also the discovery type of question, or analyzing, how did I do this? Or how could you solve that problem? A good time to use that question is when a student comes to you and says, how do I do this? A math problem, for example. And you can ask him a simpler step of that. I used the example already where to use 17 gallons of gas and drive 500 miles, how many miles per gallon? He has no idea what to do. I say, well, suppose you went 2 miles and used 2 gallons of gas. How many miles per gallon? Well, one. Well, how do you know? Well, I don't know. I just know. And then you see, what you have to do is back up and say, now, what was the process? You did one of four things. You either multiplied, divided, added, or subtracted. What did you do? So then he has to back up and think about how he thought and say, well, if you pick your numbers there, pick 2 and 2 are not good numbers to pick because of various combinations there with 2 squared and 2 times 2 and 2 plus 2. But if 2 goes into 3 or into 6 3 times, well, then all you're doing, you already know how to do it. All you're doing is changing the numbers. And so go back and use the same method, but change the numbers. See, you did know how to do it. Otherwise, you couldn't have told me the answer to that simple problem. And so sometimes you can lead a student to think about how he arrived at his answer. Now, some hints on asking questions and responding to questions. Be earnest. Don't be overbearing. Don't be intimidating. Don't make the students scared to answer because of showing their ignorance or whatever. On the other hand, don't talk down to them. Let's say, all right, now class, did any of you read the story that you're supposed to read for today? Or our main character, was it a cat or was it a dog? Well, if you ask questions that are too condescending or too insulting your intelligence, that doesn't set a good tone at all. For number 3 there, plan ahead. Sometimes a couple good questions can give you structure for the whole class, especially in history or a science class. Sometimes give your students a question or questions ahead of time because that gives them not only purpose for the reading that they're doing, but also it gives them good idea of what we'll talk about in class tomorrow, and they will come to class with some answers. So some good questions can provide structure for almost a whole class. And number five, direct questions to the whole class first. Generally, do that first. Allow everybody to think. If you just ask one person, everyone else has a free ticket to go on vacation until you and that person are finished coming up with the correct answer, or they might think they are. So, and then sometimes allow several responses. If you answer, say, fine, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Ask somebody else, what do you think? Or what would you say? And get two or three or four responses to it. Get them to think. That helps them realize it's now, depending on what the question is, of course, if the first person answers, why, that's it. It's a yes or no, but not necessarily, because somebody else might say no. And so it helps them realize that really when you think, there's a lot to think about, and it isn't all said in just one sentence. And just because somebody gives his answer doesn't mean that the thinking has ended. And, of course, be sure they understand the question. It's interesting, sometimes your question can be misinterpreted. And when they answer why, try to find, even if it's wrong, try to find, oftentimes, find some element of truth in it, or you might tell them the question they answered, oh, well, that's not quite what I meant. That's true, that, and you give the answer that they gave, or tell them what question they answered, but what I really meant to ask was this. Now, don't always do that. Students shouldn't feel that. I mean, you can sometimes do gymnastics to try to find something in the answer they gave that fits. Sometimes the simplest thing to say is simply no, but, and move on. So balance that. And avoid needless questions. If students ask questions that aren't really sincere or they're time-consuming, trying to lead you down a rabbit trail or get you off the subject, sometimes you need to turn away their questions and just stick to the subject. And another fascinating thing to do is assign them to bring questions to next day's class. And ask you questions. Maybe even open yourself up for them to question you tomorrow. And that energizes students, especially in a content subject. You say, tomorrow, you may ask me whatever you want, or tell them at the beginning of the class, go ahead and ask me what you want to about the subject. And you don't know everything and don't need to pretend to know everything, but that it's harder to ask a good question than it is to answer one. And so that stimulates them to ask and to think about the subject. Now, one other thing I'll say about questioning is you can, when you ask a question, there are those students who will have this feeling that if I just sit here a little bit long enough, the teacher will eventually call on somebody else. And so teacher asks me a question, and so I kind of start the stopwatch to see 1, 2, 3, about 5 seconds. Teacher, the attention will be off of me. She'll ask somebody else, and then I'm free. Well, you don't want anybody to always have that pattern. I mean, they should have the feel that if I ask a question, I'd like you to think and say something. So there are various things you can do. If I ask you a question and you don't respond, I can ask you, what are you thinking? Think out loud. What are you thinking? Or I can rephrase the question. If you can't give the overall answer, you might know one thing about it. And I can simplify it. Now, one thing that can happen, though, if I rephrase a question once or twice, about the third time I rephrase it and make it simpler, you're going to start feeling pretty silly because it looks like you don't know anything about it. And so as you ask questions, you have to consider whether further rephrasing of the question to make it more simple will embarrass a person or whether you should just move on. But try rephrasing and making questions a bit simpler. Now, there are several levels of questioning. I'd like us to practice a bit with these. One writer has come up with these four levels of questions. Literal questions are ones that require a strict recall of information. And don't let anyone make you think these questions don't have their place. Don't think that you need to ask all your questions on, quote, higher levels, because it is important if you're going to read and understand what you've read and talk about a story. It's important to know the facts, to be able to recall things, to define things. Otherwise, you can't think, because you have to have the facts in order to think. And so these questions do have their place, especially early on in discussing something or in adding to a discussion or a story. And then the next level, which we need to be able to do, students need to be able to answer, is the inference kind of question, where you use the facts to read between the lines. You select things, you come to some kind of conclusion, you interpret in some way. You take the information and use it to figure something out. The third level is critical thinking, or critical questions, and that involves looking analytically, analyzing something, and making some kind of a judgment, whether it's accurate, whether it's good, bad, valid, whether it's an opinion or a fact. And then the last is a creative question, where you take the information from what you've read and you really leave the subject and somehow solve a problem or becomes a divergent type of thinking. Now, you'll notice that this is somewhat related to Bloom's taxonomy. But what I'd like to do is take a few minutes and let's see. I read the story to you about tomorrow, and I think we'll take a couple minutes. I'd like you each to try to write one question based on tomorrow, said Toad, that story, one of each type. One literal question, one interpretive, requires us to read between the lines, one critical question, and one creative question. Just quickly on scratch paper, and then I'll call for some responses in a few minutes. For those of you who didn't hear the whole story, well, you can still ask some questions. It's a story. It's a story about Toad. And you can try to come up with some questions. I'm not doing any more than that. If you need some IDs, you can check with the person beside you and talk them over. You want to fire your question out. Ask them. Mark thinks this is a pretty impressive amount. All right, let's get started. You can think while we're going over this. First of all, let's have a couple literal questions. Just call them out loud.
What was one job to get to do?
All right, one of those jobs. Good. What else? Another one. Yes. Did Toad have anything to do? What else?
It was a visitor.
It was a visitor. Good. One more. Again? Right. He wouldn't have gotten the job done if he didn't do as well as he did. Or would he have done as good as he did? Okay. All right. All right. Why did he feel as good as he did? That would be a recall. It actually tells you in the story why he did. Literal questions are not, don't let anybody leave you under the impression that these questions are not important. They're really the first question. Because if you don't know what happened, and you see, the value here is to notice. Some people don't notice significant things that are right there in the text, right there in the story. Was Frog his friend? I think it actually says that, I believe. All right, next level, an interpretive question. Something we can definitely answer from the story, but it doesn't tell us in so many words.
Was Toad lazy?
Who thinks he was? All right. Doesn't say he was lazy. Doesn't even use the word, does it? What else? Good. Why did Toad change his mind? Did Toad change his mind? What else? Again? Was Toad sloppy? All right. Why was he discouraged? Do you think this is the first experience Toad ever had like this? And then that's maybe getting down to creative, but what do you think Toad will do the next time his work piles up, or will pile up again? You make predictions. All right, let's have some critical. This is where we evaluate. Now, actually, I've decided in order he's lazy. This is a bit of overlap. Anytime you make categories, sometimes your categories break down. But let's get some critical questions. Where we make some judgments, some opinions, state something about right or wrong, good, bad, worthwhile. All right. Is the principle here, should we say we should work before we rest? What do you think? You could talk about that. Was Frog a good friend of Toad? It's kind of thinking. Any child who knows something can happen can think on these levels. It's different types of thinking. And after you ask a question, sometimes when you ask a question, you have to go back and ask a recall question to pull something in order to supply what you need for your critical question. So we were asking about Frog. A good critical question would be, was Frog a good friend of Toad? And how do you know he was a friend? And then you could also ask something like, you can make a generalization. So, does a good friend sometimes calls you or help you to do that which you should, or does he do it? Would it have been better? Okay, here's a critical one, evaluating. Would it have been better for Frog to clean up Toad's house for him? What do you think would have happened? Would it have been better? That's one question. What do you think would have happened? Would have been a predicted question. What else? Good. Could a 6-year-old answer that? Sure. Do 6-year-olds ever have something they need to do, like clean up the plate or clean up? Yes, they can identify with that. Right. What about a creative question? Something that takes off from this story and has something to do with life. Let's hear one. All right. Yes. Is Toad going to have some problems tomorrow with nothing to do, maybe with boredom? Or we can start making an application question. Which season of the year do you think we are the most likely to feel like Toad? Winter, summer, spring? Wow, we have to think about that one. Of course, we're not even sure that there is a season like that, but you start thinking about some things we didn't think about before. Did you ever feel toadish? Who of you has ever filled the role of Frog with a friend? Do you have any friends like Toad? Do you have any friends like Frog? What else? Other creative questions that take off from here and apply to life.
little brother acted like Toad. What can you do to help him?
All right. Now that you could, if you left your last phrase off of there, that actually gives you two questions. What would you do? And then, what would you do to help him? Questioning is really the heart of learning and the heart of teaching, and asking questions is so much fun that sometimes you can hardly read through the selection to get to the end. Now, this other sheet, I believe you have one that says Bloom's Taxonomy Cognitive. Now, I know you see this list. Benjamin Bloom was an educator who came up with this list, and people have been memorizing this list ever since. And let me just remind you that each one of these types of thinking and questioning is important. And it's true that it gets more complicated as you go down, but one of the most foolish things a person can do is to start at the bottom and try to work up, try to evaluate, try to analyze something if you don't know what the facts are. You hear people, you call them opinionated or whatever. They have all kinds of ideas about how things should be done, but they don't know the facts. So yes, the facts are important. Now, the reason I gave you this sheet was for you to see how these kinds of questions can be applied to any story you read. This is the kind of thing that can make the difference between a reading class and a reading class. Reading class A and reading class B. Do we read the story, take turns reading, and then do the workbook? Or is it hard to even get the class over in time because we have that many questions that we want to ask and things to talk about? So you take a simple story like Goldilocks. Yes, you can recall the items. Well, explain why Goldilocks liked Baby Bear's chair best. That's not too difficult. Now we get down to, what would Goldilocks use if she came into your house? What do you think she would, what would a girl like that do if she wandered into your house and nobody was home? There isn't any soup there. So what might she do? Well, you see, you have to take, Goldilocks is a typical curious girl, and she wanders into a house. What would she do in your situation? And that question can be answered. Because you think of your house and what's in your house, and oh, I think she would probably start pushing the buttons in the microwave or whatever. And then another one, compare Goldilocks to real life. What could not have happened? See, here we're analyzing. Here's a story that's made up. Here's real life. What could have happened and what could not have happened? What elements of this story are obviously made up and what elements could very well have happened? Well, it's true that girls do eat soup. Do bears eat soup? Probably not. And it involves analyzing. All right, synthesizing. I like this one. How would the story have been different if it were Goldilocks and the three fishes? Or Goldilocks and the three elephants? Or Goldilocks and the three skunks? Or Goldilocks and the three mice? You see, you take the same concept. It's really a story of a curious girl being put in a situation where she can do something mischievous. And now you put it in different situations. What would it be like there? All right. Or if it were the other way around, how about if Goldilocks had been a bear and the people going out for the walk had been people? And Goldilocks were a bear cub, and the people coming home were people. How would it be different? And then last of all, evaluation. Was Goldilocks good, bad? Was Goldilocks naughty? And why do you think so? That's one type. There are other evaluation questions could be answered. Now, the last step there is called metacognition. Means it's a question that requires you to think about your thinking. Explain how you arrived at that position. Explain why you think that. That's difficult for many of us to do, and all of us to do about some things. But How did you arrive at this conclusion? You can take this list or the other list or other kinds of lists of types of questions, and you can take the simplest story. Let me read you another one, because you see, you read some like this that are more literary, but you're not likely to have as many of those in your book. Let me read you another one here. This is out of a first grade book. Something sweet. "Come," said mother to the cub. "It is time to hunt something to eat. You must obey me. Stay close to me." Now, what I'd like to do is stop partway through here, more like we actually might do in a reading class, and you play teacher, and you simply ask something for the group to answer based on what we've read so far. "You must obey me. Stay close to me." Mother and the cub left the den. Mother began to hunt for something to eat. She turned a big stone over. Grubs went everywhere. "Eat," said mother as she ate. "I will try it," said the cub to himself. He tumbled a stone over. It fell on him, and the grubs got away. "Next time, tumble the stone away from you," said mother. All right, I'll stop there and just ask some questions, any type of question that you might ask the class at this point. All right. The bears like to eat.
What did mother bear tell the cub he was doing when they killed him?
Mm-hmm. What else? Pardon?
Why did they leave the den?
Why should the cub stay close to his mother?
Right. What do you suppose, she said you should obey me, what do you suppose might happen if he doesn't? What else?
Why don't you tell him to roll the stone the other way?
All right. Do you think she had to tell him to roll the stone the other way? What do you call that? All right, how about this one? Suppose he rolls the stone the next time, which way do you think he'll roll it? Away from him or onto the top of him? Suppose he does roll on top of him. What does that tell you about his intelligence? What else could we ask? The grubs got away. What do you think they did? Did they go on the ground, fly, crawl? All right. Other questions? If we had the time here, what I'd do is give you a few paragraphs like this and see if you can come up with 35 questions based on this. Why? Because the first 20 don't count. You see, the first 20 any of us could ask. It's after you've exhausted your list of questions and you get to those last 15, that's when the questions start to get interesting and make you think. All right, let's push this a little further. What else can we ask? Have we exhausted everything there is to ask about this?
How bear is strong.
Mm-hmm.
How big a rock do you suppose the cub used?
All right.
What relationship are the bears?
All right, to each other. Mm-hmm. And why were the grubs under the rock, do you suppose? Yes. All right.
Why didn't mother bear turn the stone over before the cub?
You say why? Why didn't?
Why didn't she?
Yes. Good. Good one. Why didn't she do it? He wouldn't have gotten hurt if she had. What else?
Where do you suppose father bear
was? Yes, anyway. Why isn't he involved here? What do you know about bears? Would he have been involved? Would that have been realistic, do you think, if Father Bear were involved? What else?
Why
The title is Something Sweet.
How does that relate to drugs?
All right. Good question. Do you think so far, do you think this story has the appropriate title based on what you know so far? Let's have a couple more yet. Good. Yes. would they have spent time looking for grubs?
Do you think this was in the winter or the summer?
All right. What season? And then you can make some applications. You could make some applications to yourself. Did you ever have an experience, anything like this, where you were really doing a job that was a good job, you're supposed to learn, but something fell on you or you got in trouble or dirty or something? Now, one more.
Do you think that's all we're going to eat
today? All right. How many grubs must a bear eat? Anyway, do you think they chewed these grubs up? Now, do you do this between every two paragraphs? Ask 30 questions? No, not every time. The reason I did it this long this time is, as I said, to get past some of the straight recall ones, and those have their place. But as you read, as your students are reading, and you as a teacher are following with them, you want to be thinking of good things to ask and a variety of things. Sometimes an application thing will pop into your mind, a curious question will pop in, maybe a little detail that they really should notice because it has something to do with the story. You want to make sure they got it. So a question or two, or allowing the students to ask a question or two. And another one to do is to give them an answer and have them try to think of a question for it. On they went up the hill. Mother sniffed the breeze. "I smell a treat," said Mother. "I smell a bee tree. It will have something sweet to eat." "What is sweet?" asked the cub. Mother smiled and said, "You will see. Stay close to me." Mother turned away. The cub trotted on. He hunted there, here and there for something sweet. The cub came to a big stump. There was something black and white next to the stump. "See, Mother," yelled the cub, "is this something sweet?" "That isn't sweet. It is a skunk," she said. "It will make your fur smell bad. Stay away from skunks and stay close to me." Two questions. Two questions that you... Who has a question you like based on that?
Why did the cub know what sweet
was? Mm-hmm. Yes, that is a profound section of that story. What is sweet, asked the cub. That cub did not have the concept of sweet. And that's not probably the kind of thing you ask the children, although you could ask him, how did you learn what sweet was? All right, let me read one more instance yet. Mother went on, but the cub didn't. Next to a tree, the cub came upon some chains. "Mother," yelled the cub, "is this something sweet?" "This trap will hurt you. It will crunch your feet," Mother said. "I see, I have much to teach you." All right, then they went on and they found some honey. Now, what do you have to say? Any questions or any comments about this section about the trap? Anything you would ask or any comments you would make? What would have happened if the bear hadn't obeyed the mother there at that point? If he got his foot in the trap, what would have happened? And, well, he'd have probably lost his life. And here's a place where you could actually make a bit of an evaluation of the story and say, do you think that if Baby Bear actually saw a trap, mother bear would stand over there and say, oh, that's a trap. If you step in that, it will hunt your feet. Or being a mother, would your mother have responded that way and said, that's a trap. Don't put your foot in that. It'll catch you. What would a typical mother do? This is probably one place where you can evaluate a bit and say, I think here that actually the author should have had mother show a bit more distress, a bit more emotion, because this was not a case of him learning something. This was a case of him saving his life. She may have actually swatted him away from it and then explained it. Well, anyway, think of if you want your children to, as you read through section by section in a story, think of logical places to stop and ask questions. And the students should have this feel that when there's a pause in our reading, if we're reading around the group, we're not just changing readers, and we're not just asking who did it and who didn't, but there are going to be some questions that will be fun to answer. Good questions really are fun to ask and fun to answer. Now, the next comments I have to do with exercises for oral reading class. You have a handout, which I won't comment on the things, but it says exercises for teaching reading. This is simply a long list of kinds of skills. I said reading is a skill subject. These are kinds of things that a reader must be able to do to read well. He needs to know how to use a dictionary. He needs to recognize that there are such things as idioms. He might not know that word, but needs to recognize something like if that's not worth a hill of beans. We don't really mean that, literally. We have to understand the idiom. Or if I feel all washed out, what does that mean? Well, it's an idiom. And so on down the line. And many of these activities are done in workbook exercises. And if you ever want to make up your own exercises, well, you can use some of these skills to do that. And there are everything from being able to find the main idea to distinguishing between facts and opinions to judging the motive of a person's actions. Number 35 is a good one, to paraphrase something, to put it into your own words. If you really understand something, you can put it in your own words, although that is a type of interpretation. And then at the bottom, there are a few specific descriptions of activities. For example, number one, locate the facts or events by finding the paragraph, the page number, and the first two words of the paragraph. Students will sometimes be able to tell you, answer a question about a story, and they're dead right. They're exactly right. But you ask them, where in that story is the answer? Read me the sentence that tells you. That's a different skill. That's an important skill. You don't want to require them to do it all the time. But what I'm saying is, if you, in a story, if you ask a question, was he angry or was he sad? And they say, well, he was angry. We say, we all agree. We're right, he was angry. But what is it in the story? Read me the sentence that tells you that. That's an important skill to do. And then number two is a little more specific yet. Find a word in the story that means something. And another one, number four, if you want to make exercises for children, simply write a list of statements about the story, all of them that sound like just accurate statements, and they check the ones that are correct, the ones that actually fit the story. Number five is where you would write some quotes that someone in the story would have said. For example, with the Good Samaritan, if one of the characters said, I don't think I'll get involved with that person. Well, there's two characters that could fit. Which character might have said, I really don't have time, might get me into trouble, but this person needs help. Now, in other words, that's actually a statement that someone could have made. One person in the story that fits to, and you have to be able to understand the character and understand who would have made a statement like that. That's the kind of thing that you could even ask the students in class to make statements that they think are in character with what the person would have said. Which person would have said this, Frog or Toad? Or what's something else that Frog might have said? Or you could ask, suppose Frog comes to Toad's house the next day and sees that he's busy cleaning his house cleaning. What might he say or do? All right, then we have frame paragraphs I'll refer to a bit later. Let's go next to the oral, a few words about oral reading. I alluded to the fact that oral reading is a separate skill. If you actually are going to grade your students on the oral reading, in other words, what I'm saying is that tomorrow I'm going to have you read, each of you take a turn reading, and I'm going to grade you on your oral reading. They should have the opportunity to pre-read that, to be prepared for it, and even to know perhaps specifically which paragraphs they're going to read, unless you want them to be prepared for the whole story. Because if you're going to read something orally and be graded on it, you need to know how to pronounce the words and how to put the right emphasis on the right places. And so some things that you want to grade for, talked about grading to teaching and grading to objectives. I'll just tell you the whole list there to save the time. These are kinds of things that can be objectives in oral reading. Every single one of those could be a separate objective, which could be emphasized one at a time. And if you're going to read tomorrow in class, I might pick out just one of those and say, tomorrow, I'm only grading you on the rate of your reading. Most of you, when you read aloud, tend to read too fast. And I want to hear you read slowly with the proper expression and a proper pauses. And you might specifically grade them on the rate and maybe pauses. Another time you might grade them on expression. And, of course, as children get older and have more experience, you can make up a little check sheet like this and grade them on the whole gamut. But these are all specific things, specific objectives for oral reading. Volume, speed, enunciation, how the words are sliced off, and the pronunciation, putting the proper expression in to match the character, and pausing properly, following punctuation, eye contact, that's a hard one to work on. You almost have to deal with that specifically and say, I'm not grading on anything else on this assignment except eye contact. That's the one thing. And probably if you zero in on that one, they might be that nervous about it that they will feel awkward. But a person has to learn if he's reading aloud, and by the way, when you read aloud, you should read aloud, you should not memorize. If you memorize, that's a different activity, that's a different story. It should be read so that you can look down and read. And being able to read a phrase and look up at your audience and read some more if you must, putting your hand there, that's a very worthwhile, very important to your audience if you're being read to. Looked at because it affects you as you deliver it. I'm actually giving it to you, not putting it back in the book. I tell them it already is in the book. You don't have to put it back in there. You want to get it out of the book and out to the audience. And you do that with your eyes and your mouth both. And then your stance. How does the person stand up there when he reads to you? A person's bearing when he reads has quite a bit to do with how it comes across. And the phrasing and the feeling that he puts into it. And you can have feeling apart from expression. The feeling is more how you are involved yourself. Would you care about what you're reading or not? Or whether it's just something you're doing because it's an assignment. The other handout I gave you, 25 things to have students do after reading an assignment. It's good to have resources like this to use in a variety of classes. How can you, being a busy teacher, and you know that, well, we want to do some things beyond just filling in workbook pages, what are some things I can do? I don't have the time to make up a whole lot of worksheets. What can I do? Well, it's nice to have a few good tools that you can use, not only in reading class, but in history or whatever. And so here are a few of them. I'll just call your attention to a few. Number two is one where you go through the selection, whether it's a history assignment or a story in reading, and you select certain words and give those words to the students in groups. The simplest would be to give them one word, or you can make groups of two. And the more you put in one group, the more difficult it becomes for your older, more capable students. And the task then is to take those three words, man, thieves, and attacked, put them in one sentence that says something accurately about the story that you read. So the sentence must be grammatically correct, but it all must also fit the story. For example, if they said the man attacked the thieves, that's grammatically correct, but it does not fill the bill. It does not fit the story of the Good Samaritan. So this is an excellent way to check comprehension at the same time that the person has to think, he has to put this together and come up with a sentence. And it can very easily be checked. When you collect those papers, you can read through that about as fast as you can read, and you know whether the person understood the story or not. Now, if you want to break it down into percents, that's can get nitty-gritty, but you can simply give an A, B, or C, or D grade. And it's fun to share these in class and have the students see that there are different ways of coming up with a sentence. Every one of them can be different. You can also challenge them to not use any ands, try to write a sentence without using the word and give them some help. Tell them to start sentences with words like until or because or while or when, and get them out, breaking them out of that long tying together using the word and. Another way that you can make this harder is to have your three words be from three different places in the story. The further apart in the story they are, the harder you have to work to pull that together. So if you said, for example, Jericho, oil, and in. Jericho, oil, and in. One sentence using your three words about the Good Samaritan. You've got to do some gymnastics to make some kind of a more general statement about that. Another one would be number six. It's a good one to something good to do with the story for tomorrow. Be prepared to be interviewed.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.